Welcome to this special audio spinoff program from two satellite CME programs held at the December 2015 ASH meeting. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. On this CD, I chat with two faculty members from our meeting on lymphomas in CLL, and on the other CD, with two faculty from our symposium on multiple myeloma. For these programs, we convened a working group of five general oncologists who helped us shape the meeting agenda and provided a plethora of cases and questions for the faculty to address. And for each meeting, we also had one of these five oncologists on the panel presenting cases. For the lymphoma session, this was Dr. Maggie Deutsch. And to begin, I met with Dr. Michael Williams, who addressed the major question from our working group and the focal point of a case of an 84-year-old woman of Dr. Deutsch, specifically the initial selection of treatment of CLL in elderly patients.
That's, of course, a very common clinical scenario. And I think as the treatment has evolved over the past couple of years, my go-to approach, and I think that of my colleagues here at the University of Virginia, has been to use obinutuzumab and chlorambucil. Although in more elderly and somewhat frail people, you have to deal with, you know, potential for infusion reactions, et cetera. But it is active, and I find it better tolerated in general than even dose-reduced bendamustine rituximab. So we tend to use, up to now, the obinutuzumab chlorambucil. I think that may evolve. Certainly already has evolved for the poor-risk cytogenetics, like 17P, where we would use ibrutinib. But I think with the data in the New England Journal back in the middle of December from John Bird's group, you know, I think ibrutinib may well become a frontline option in the near future if it's approved and would be a consideration for this patient.
Can you talk about those data that you just mentioned that came out on ibrutinib?
Yeah, so it was a straightforward study where they compared ibrutinib against chlorambucil frontline, and it showed, you know, results that we would expect. Most patients treated with chlorambucil had stable disease. Only about a third of them responded, whereas with ibrutinib, close to 90% responded. And in fact, what was intriguing about the study is that the ibrutinib-treated patients virtually all were maintaining their response out to 2 years, 18 to 24 months, whereas chlorambucil patients had progression, and in fact, there was a survival benefit for ibrutinib versus chlorambucil in those patients. So it was an impressive set of data.
You mentioned the issue of obinutuzumab, and one of the things I'm starting to hear from select investigators is the thought of using obinutuzumab alone. I know in the community, in the past, prior to obinutuzumab, there were docs who used rituximab alone. Maybe you did also. What about the use of anti-CD20 monoclonal antibodies alone upfront in CLL?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a reasonable option for selected patients. We have used single-agent rituximab in the past. The activity is not, you know, as high as it is in indolent lymphomas. But I think obinutuzumab, I'm convinced it has more activity in CLL based on its sort of refined mechanisms of action, better ADCC, et cetera. So I think it's not a bad option at all for these patients. And I think you can potentially get around some of those infusion reactions by doing two or three lower dose administrations before you go to the full dose. When people have a high circulating tumor burden, there's just, you know, more risk of the reactions. And so you just have to kind of tiptoe into it a little bit more.
Is it your experience? I've heard people say that usually pretty much all the problem is the first cycle.
That's right. That's right. It really is the first dose or two. And once you get past that, they seem to do pretty well with it.
You know, it's kind of strange, but I remember at another ASH symposium a few years ago, we had a case presented, and it was actually a case from Europe, a patient who was enrolled in a trial in Europe. And they said, well, this is a trial of another anti-CD20 antibody. And at that point, I don't even think it had a name. And the patient had this great response. And yet, I don't know whether it's just the nature of CLL or not. I don't know whether people have a feel yet in their own practice for, you know, sort of the efficacy. You mentioned that it was your feeling that, you know, well, obviously the trial showed it was more efficacious than rituximab. Is it also your clinical experience?
It is. And I mean, we haven't sort of done a head-to-head of course. But my impression is that you do get somewhat faster and deeper responses with the obinutuzumab.
So Dr. Deutsch presented another case that was interesting of a younger patient, which led into the issue of management of upfront therapy in the younger patient. And first of all, her case is a little bit different in that there was an 11q deletion. And she wanted to know sort of what does that mean and how does that compare to, say, 17p? What's your answer?
Well, so the comparison is that the 11Qs do tend to behave somewhat more favorably than the 17Ps. You know, the clinical presentation is often different in that the 11Q deleted patients often present with a somewhat lower circulating burden of disease, but more adenopathy. And there's pretty strong data that FCR for the 11Q deleted population may be a better regimen, certainly better than FC. And it may also, you know, appears better than BR, potentially. So I think FCR in a younger patient with that subtype, the 11Q deleted, is a very appropriate, you know, frontline treatment.
And we actually asked as a poll question, just in general, about management of younger patients. We use 62-year-old, as in this case, with normal risk cytogenetics. And the audience, as well as it seemed like the faculty, was, as you were saying, much more inclined toward FCR. Can you talk about the data that sort of supports that trend?
Yeah. The context for our practice here is that over the past 3 or 4 years, we'd really shifted largely toward BR as our frontline treatment, even in younger patients, and many of them do very well with that. But with the BR versus FCR data, FCR came out looking better pretty much across the groups, more toxicity than you saw with BR, but there was more MRD negativity and longer durations of response with FCR. And as I mentioned in my presentation at the ASH symposium, there was a paper in Blood this past year that looked at risk factors. If you had 17P or 11Q and unmutated, then you tended to do pretty poorly, whereas patients that didn't have those high-risk features and got FCR, they had high responses. And what was impressive is that many of them are very durable, almost a plateau on those curves. And I think that's the cohort of people that you hear about from the MD Anderson experience and others that, you know, they have 8-10 year remissions. So because of that, we've really shifted back to FCR for those standard and lower risk patients who need treatment in the younger age setting.
How do you respond to the thought of using ibrutinib in those patients, normal risk cytogenetics, with the thinking, you know, obviously it's much better tolerated, but on the other hand, you're going to have to take it for a long time?
Well, so that's, I think, you know, a hot button issue going forward because we don't have the data yet to say that that's going to be a better outcome. Certainly, you'd like to spare people some of the toxicity of FCR. And we know that ibrutinib-treated patients in the front line can do well and can apparently do well durably. But we just don't know what the longer-term, intermediate and longer-term duration of response is going to be. We don't know how well people treated with ibrutinib for that period of time will then respond to a second-line treatment. There was a very useful review in JAMA Oncology from Jennifer Woyak and the Ohio State group that looked at why people discontinued ibrutinib, whether it was in the front line or the relapse setting. It was pooled experience from their trials. And a good proportion of the people who stopped therapy, it was because of infection, less often some other side effect or toxicity. But a proportion of the CLL patients, you know, small numbers, but those who did progress had BTK mutations that mediated their resistance. And there was also a smaller cohort still that had Richter's transformation as their progression. Many of those had the 17p deletion and were higher risk, but those patients clinically did very poorly. Most of them did not have BTK mutations, so it appears to be a different mechanism when they evolve. So, you know, we'd sure all like to use an oral drug that works well and has low toxicity, but I think the jury's still out pending additional studies about whether that becomes a standard frontline.
As long as you brought up the idea of BTK mutations, what do we know about other BTK inhibitors in CLL?
Right. Well, so there are some others that are in development, of course. Acalabrutinib, I believe, is very active, was just also published in the New England Journal, their data. And whether that drug will be able to get responses in ibrutinib-resistant patients, I mean, there's very limited data on that as yet. So maybe that would be another option. Maybe you could use a combination of targeted agents to either prevent the emergence of resistance or to get a deeper, faster response and then go into more of a maintenance mode. So there's a lot to learn with these.
So another case we had was presented by the other oncologist, and Dr. Deutsch represented that doc, Dr. Morgenstein, a 73-year-old patient, first of all, who had a 17p-deleted CLL. Actually, this patient had a complication, but just we had asked the audience about the approach to upfront therapy in del17p CLL. What we've seen in investigators, and maybe not quite as unanimous in the audience at ASH, is a straightforward answer, which is ibrutinib. What do we know about ibrutinib and 17P, and is that pretty much standard of care?
Well, so I think it is a standard of care, both in the frontline and the relapse setting. What we know about treating those patients with it is that while they do much better than previous chemoimmunotherapy-based regimens, that the responses are higher and they appear to be more durable, but there's a fairly steady relapse rate over the first 2 to 3 years. And as I mentioned earlier, when they relapse, it can be as a Richter's or other poor risk progression. So one of the things that I think is a challenge right now is if you have a younger, fit person, meaning say under the age of 60, 65, with 17p deleted disease, they need treatment, you get them on ibrutinib, they get a good response. My approach is to have a transplant discussion with them and to sort of line that up. If they have siblings, I get a consultation from a transplant physician. We consider getting matching of siblings if that's available. And we typically then stay with the ibrutinib. I haven't had anybody go to transplant while enjoying an ibrutinib response, but we monitor them pretty closely. It's very much analogous to me to the pre-imatinib days in CML, where you have people in chronic phase who have a good quality of life and they're doing all right, but you know that if they start to accelerate and progress, then their window of curability for an allo may disappear. So it's, to me, similar to that. So it's a discussion with patients, and we don't know quite how to move forward with that yet, but that's something I think that needs to be kept in mind when you're counseling these patients.
So this particular patient that we were talking about, the 73-year-old, actually developed one of the complications that we've heard about with ibrutinib, specifically atrial fibrillation. And the question was, the patient was actually responding to ibrutinib at that point, what do you do? And also, we asked the audience what they would do, and we said, assume venetoclax is available. So maybe you can talk about what venetoclax is, what we know about it, and you know what you do right now when somebody goes into atrial fibrillation with ibrutinib.
Yeah, so those are two important questions. So venetoclax is very active. It's a BCL2 inhibitor that turns out to be highly active in relapse CLL, including 17p deleted. We learned early on that you have to use a cautious stepped-up dosing approach because of risk of tumor lysis syndrome, which can be severe and life-threatening. And with the stepped-up dosing, this was reported at ASH and more recently in the literature, you can circumvent the serious clinical tumor lysis syndrome. So that would be a good second option. Our group here at the University of Virginia and others are looking at combining venetoclax with ibrutinib. We've just started a phase 1 study of that combination with mantle cell lymphoma based on very strong preclinical data. So it's one example among many of combination targeted therapies that may find a place as we go forward.
But that one particularly sounds intriguing, really.
Yeah. The preclinical data is pretty dramatic. So you've got two very active drugs with distinct mechanisms of action that I think have the potential to give a deep response You know, maybe even you can get MRD negative responses. And then you start to have the option to then do, you know, maintenance therapy with, say, just one of the drugs or even interrupted therapy. Who knows? But the other part of your question, which is an important one, is what do you do with a patient who's having a great response to ibrutinib, but they get AFib? And there's debate about that. Our general approach is to continue the ibrutinib and to put the patient on lower dose systemic anticoagulation to help prevent the thrombotic risk from the AFib. Now, others would say, gee, because of the bleeding risk on ibrutinib, we would never continue it if they have to go on anticoagulation. So you have to take into account what the patient's other meds are, what their overall bleeding risk is. Have they already had bleeding complications with ibrutinib, you know, very easy bruising or a hematoma or something? So it's a clinical judgment and one that you have to just take on a case-by-case basis.
Have you yourself had patients develop atrial fibrillation, and what's the mechanism?
Yeah, so if the mechanism is understood, it's not known to me. But in my experience, I certainly have had patients with it, and all but one, I've had four or five probably over the last few years, all but one had a prior history of intermittent AFib. And some of them were already on a low-dose anticoagulant, and so it was not such a hard decision as far as what we did going forward. And I think you have to be careful. I had a patient recently who was an 82-year-old gentleman and developed AFib, but it was in the setting that he came in with an NSTEMI, you know, coronary ischemic event, and he had transient AFib, and I think it was due to the ischemia more than the drug. So we left him on the drug, and he's not had any further AFib in the last 3 months.
So right now, we don't have venetoclax available. It is fast-tracked by the FDA specifically for 17P. If it does become approved and is sort of equally accessible to ibrutinib, which of the two drugs would you likely use for 17P?
Boy, that's a good question. Right now, I think just because of the experience we have, I would probably stick with ibrutinib for right now. And, you know, there's also, you don't have to deal with that potential tumor lysis risk and very close monitoring. I mean, one thing I didn't mention earlier that's worth pointing out is that in the venetoclax studies, for the initial dose or the first step-up dose, those patients are, in the studies, admitted for tumor lysis monitoring. So that obviously adds a complication and an expense to initiation of therapy that right now we don't have to deal with ibrutinib. Maybe we'll learn in the future that we don't have to be quite that vigilant for most patients. So for now, to answer your question, with what I know, I'd stick with ibrutinib.
So again, getting back to the patient who has a problem with ibrutinib, for example, atrial fibrillation, what's your usual response in that situation? A lot of people and a lot of the audience would use adalimumab, usually with rituximab.
Yeah, I think that's a very good option for these people. If you decide you just don't want to go back to ibrutinib or the toxicity has been such that you're not able to, I think idela and rituximab, you know, it's certainly shown to be a very active regimen. And so I think that's a reasonable option for these patients.
And, you know, globally, it's always hard to compare indirectly. But is it your sense that ibrutinib is more efficacious than adalimumab rituximab?
I guess my sense is that it likely is, although the patient populations it's been studied in, you know, differ somewhat. So you're right, it is hard to compare them. Different side effect profile too. And of course, you've got the rituximab infusions that add another layer to the patient's treatment. So there's a fair number of differences.
While we're talking about adalimumab, maybe you can just briefly comment on why, when it's utilized or its approval with CLL, it's with rituximab, and yet with follicular lymphoma, the other area that it's approved in, it's alone.
Yeah, I guess it's based, I guess, primarily on the way the original data was generated with the combination for CLL. So whether there would be potentially more benefit with, say, follicular if you added the rituximab is not unreasonable to anticipate.
We were talking before about obinutuzumab. Is there interest in or trials looking at obinutuzumab in combination with some of these novel agents, for example, adalimumab?
Yeah, I don't know the obinutuzumab idela experience thus far. It has been combined with ibrutinib, And that's a combination that you can give safely. And one of the advantages of putting an anti-CD20 with ibrutinib and related agents is that you sort of blunt the height and the duration of the lymphocytosis that comes with the oral therapy.
Speaking of lymphocytes, we had another case that one of the general oncologists, Dr. Lyle Feinstein, wanted to have presented. 75-year-old man presents with shortness of breath, and CBC showed a hemoglobin of 7.7, platelet count 87,000, white count of 426,000, predominantly lymphocytes. And his question was, as the patient had shortness of breath, is there a lymphocyte count at which a patient should be considered for leukapheresis?
Yeah, so I know that some investigators would leukapherese somebody like this. I mean, this is an elderly gentleman. We don't typically think about leukostasis from CLL, but if you're starting above 400,000, those patients are likely to get into a range that would make any of us pretty nervous. And so I think it's not unreasonable to sort of debulk them, if you will, or cytoreduce them by leukapheresis before you add the BTK inhibitor.
As long as we're talking about white counts, in an asymptomatic patient, is there a white count at which you would treat based on the white count?
So I typically don't treat just based on the white count. I mean, if it's really doubling rapidly and you're getting up above 250,000, 300,000, then I start to at least monitor them more closely. But I usually find that they're starting to get fatigue or symptomatically anemic, or their platelet count is starting to drop down below 80,000, 90,000. So they usually have some other clear reason, if it's not adenopathy and splenomegaly as another option, that would tip me to treat them.
So I want to move on and talk now a little bit about mantle cell lymphoma. And Dr. Deutsch presented a 72-year-old man in her practice, splenomegaly, circulating lymphocytes. Actually, they thought initially that the patient had CLL, and turns out they had mantle cell. The patient was asymptomatic, and white count was in the 50 to 60,000 range. And she actually had been observing him for the last year, and he's been stable. And she wanted some feedback on this concept of observing patients with mantle cell up front.
So we know that about 15 to 20% of patients with mantle cell will present with a clinically indolent subtype, and many of them are just like this patient. They look like CLL. And it reminds us that when we have a patient like this, you're working them up for, of course, they're CD5 positive, but if the CLL FISH markers are negative, then you want to look for the 1114 to see if this is in fact what you're dealing with. So in this patient, if he's clinically asymptomatic, the platelet count would be the thing that I would be concerned about and watching very closely, that would be a treatment indication. But some of these patients will go for many months, or even I've had them go 2 to 3 years. I'm seeing one back in my clinic tomorrow that was diagnosed 2 years ago, and she's clinically unchanged, at least over the past 20 to 22 months, in terms of the white count and the adenopathy, which is minimal. So she's quite happy to be followed without treatment.
She also presented a 57-year-old man who did require treatment, and we asked the audience about induction or initial therapy of the younger patient. We saw a wide variety of responses. Can you talk about how you approach the younger patient?
Well, so for most younger patients with certainly higher risk, high MIPI score, you know, blastoid variant, et cetera, mantle cell lymphoma, if they're otherwise fit, we generally recommend treatment with a high-dose cytarabine-containing regimen followed by an auto transplant. And that's based on data from a variety of sources. I think there's also reasonable rationale for giving those patients maintenance rituximab based on the RDHAP trial that the Lima group, Stephen Legui, presented that as an update. That group did at ASH this year. So I think that's a reasonable approach. Now, somebody, if they've got comorbid disease, some other health concerns, or they don't want to consider high-dose therapy, then a patient like this, we would offer the cooperative group trial of bendamustine rituximab with or without bortezomib, and then they go on to either maintenance rituximab or to R-squared with lenalidomide rituximab. So that's the current cooperative group trial, intergroup trial that should complete its accrual this spring. So it's getting close.
You mentioned the bortezomib aspect to the trial. This drug is approved upfront in mantle cell, I think, with sort of R-CHOP or a variation of that without the vincristine. What do you see as the role for that strategy right now outside a trial setting? And what about BR bortezomib outside a trial setting?
Right. So I think it's not an unreasonable approach. We don't have much data as yet on bortezomib plus BR. But you're correct that at ASCO 2 years ago, and then it's since been published, a CHOP-like regimen called VR-CAP, which was bortezomib, rituximab, and basically CHOP without vincristine, was utilized and compared to R-CHOP alone and showed a significant benefit in both response rate and duration of response. More thrombocytopenia when you put bortezomib into that chemotherapy regimen, and the neuropathy was fairly similar to what you saw with vincristine. So it's very active, but I think we don't know a lot about, with BR as yet, what the toxicity is going to be for that. So I'd be cautious about just combining it with BR as yet. But VR-CAP, you know, bringing bortezomib into the frontline setting is a regimen that we would use. We have used it, especially in patients who are not going on to the clinical trial that I mentioned.
Another case was presented, a 75-year-old patient with mantle cell who, as is often the case, was treated with BR upfront, but after 18 months developed moderately symptomatic disease progression. And we actually asked the audience not only what their next treatment might be, but the next two treatments, you know, theoretically, what their algorithm is. And we have three approved agents, ibrutinib, lenalidomide, and bortezomib. Actually, the most common thinking was ibrutinib followed by lenalidomide. But right now, how do you think about which of these three to start out with and how you sequence then?
So it's a great question. To my mind right now, just because of the level of response that can be achieved, I usually put bortezomib off as something that I reserve for later or potentially for a later combination, unless the patient, say, has severe renal impairment or some other reason I might want to use bortezomib. So to me, the sequencing outside of a clinical trial would be ibrutinib first, and then lenalidomide, but I would give the lenalidomide with rituximab, which enhances the lenalidomide response considerably. So if you took the reverse order, that's a perfectly reasonable approach in my view.
And what's your experience in terms of responsiveness to these three agents, clinical activity, both of what we know from clinical trials as well as your own clinical experience?
Yeah, so bortezomib alone, the reported response is about a third of patients, which is also the same for lenalidomide as a single agent in bortez-treated patients. So higher responses with lenalidomide if it's given with rituximab. What's interesting, and this is, you know, sort of dangerous anecdote, but I'll say it anyway, is I've got a couple of patients, one of whom had a stem cell transplant for mantle cell 8 years ago, and then had a sort of a focal GI progression, a little bit of systemic disease, got bortezomib single agent, and he's 5 years out from that now. I mean, he's still in remission.
Wow.
So, and I've had other people tell me they've seen that as well. So, I mean, I don't know how to account for it. I'm happy when you see it happen. But bortezomib is an important drug and shouldn't be forgotten. But the response rate, the peripheral neuropathy is something that one has to be aware of. In terms of responses to the other agents, ibrutinib is certainly a very active drug, but you know, the response rate is about 60%, maybe 65%. And that was true in the European study that was just presented at ASH and published in Lancet that showed similar responses in about two-thirds of patients. So a third don't respond at all. And the response duration with single-agent ibrutinib is about 14 to 15 months. And you have to be cautious about monitoring those people because when those patients progress through ibrutinib, it can be a very rapid progression. So you have to be poised with your next line of treatment strategy so that you can get those patients worked up, staged, and on treatment without too much delay.
You mentioned before the lenalidomide rituximab maintenance therapy that's being looked at in the ECOG trial. What about R-squared as an induction regimen or in the relapse refractory setting for mantle cell?
Well, it's important to remember that there's preclinical rationale for the R-squared approach, and that is that one of the ways lenalidomide enhances rituximab effect is that when you've got lenalidomide present, it enhances the immune synapse formation between rituximab-labeled B-cell malignancies and effector cells like T-cells and NK cells. So you get a better therapeutic response with the combination. So Jia Ruan and a small multi-center group, Sony Smith and John Leonard and others were involved in that trial, was just published in November in the New England Journal of Medicine. Small cohort of, I think, 35 or 38 patients, but really, to me, dramatically active. These were older patients, often comorbid disease, and they had about a 92% ongoing benefit out to 18 to 24 months with no chemotherapy. It was frontline treatment. So it's a very active regimen. And I think the exciting thing about it is that it's a great proof of principle that we have agents now combining immunotherapy and targeted therapy. Maybe it'll be combined targeted therapies that I think are going to pretty quickly start supplanting cytotoxic chemotherapy as the initial treatment for patients with some B-cell malignancies. So it's a very exciting prospect to think about.
Anything going on in the upfront mantle cell trial setting, you know, comparable to the study that's being done in follicular lymphoma, looking at a non-chemotherapy approach? So they're looking at R-squared, but as you mentioned, you have all these other targeted agents. Any other big cooperative studies that are looking at a non-chemo approach to mantle cell up front?
Well, so those studies are in planning right now from the U.S. intergroup. The next generation of mantle cell studies, either younger patients or those with high-risk disease and older or patients with comorbid disease, those studies are in planning right now, but it will include this kind of strategy as one of the treatment arms.
I want to finish out talking about diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And we actually had one of the cases that was presented of a 57-year-old patient who had IHC-confirmed ABC subtype and wanted to know whether or not to approach the patient differently outside of a trial setting. First, just to take a step back, and we actually asked the audience, do they think that molecular phenotyping should be part of sort of community-based oncology? And actually, most said yes, although most of the faculty said no. What are your thoughts about molecular phenotyping right now in the community-based setting?
Well, there's two aspects of molecular phenotyping right now for de novo large cell lymphoma. One is cell of origin, where I think it is important that that be done. How it's done, is it best done by true molecular testing, by gene expression profiling, or can you do it phenotypically where you look at MUM1 and CD10, BCL6, BCL2, et cetera? I think it's important because we know that if you have the non-germinal center B cell or the ABC subtype, that those patients tend to do more poorly with standard R-chemo, like R-CHOP. And we also have data now that that poorer risk subtype, actually those are the patients who have the best responses to ibrutinib and to lenalidomide. So if you know that information, then you have the ability to apply those potentially in the relapse setting. And of course, there's an ECOG trial, intergroup trial right now of R-CHOP versus R-squared CHOP with lenalidomide plus rituximab and CHOP that is accruing, and we hope that study will finish in the summer. And there's an industry-sponsored trial that is underway as well, looking at R-CHOP versus R2-CHOP. The industry trial is including only the non-germinal center subtype. So I think cell of origin testing is appropriate to obtain for de novo patients. Now, the other molecular typing is for the MYC positive, the MYC translocated, or the MYC expressing patients. There's also the so-called double or triple hits where they have a MYC translocation plus BCL2 and or BCL6 translocation. The true double hits or triple hits are only maybe 5 or 6% of large cells, but they tend to do very poorly with standard therapy. We don't know how best to treat them outside of a trial right now. I think many of us, if not most in the lymphoma world, are treating them with dose-adjusted R-EPOC. Now, the double expressors, where you have staining that's positive for MYC and BCL2, they are sort of intermediate to the translocated and the MYC negative ones. And those patients right now, we don't adjust our treatment based on just expression, but that is being tested in the next cooperative group trial. So we'll try to get, you know, we do very well with a lot of large cell lymphomas, but there are still a significant number for whom our standard treatments fail. And it's possible that these molecular markers will help us refine and risk adapt treatment to get better outcomes.
You mentioned before the idea, and actually the doc with the case had brought up the idea of lenalidomide and diffuse large B cell with the ABC subtype. But we also asked the audience, we've asked this many, many times at CME meetings, and I'm always amazed at the answer. It's a very simple question. Do you use lenalidomide outside a protocol setting for patients with diffuse large B cell? And what we've seen when we asked investigators about this is they pretty much all use it in the relapse refractory setting. But we always see, and with this particular audience, we had 60% of docs say no, they don't use it. And it's kind of been a little confusing to me about that dichotomy. Do you use lenalidomide in relapse refractory diffuse large B cell? And what have you observed with it?
Right. So we absolutely use it. And I've recommended it to oncologists who call me with cases of relapsed and refractory disease. We generally use it only in patients with the non-germinal center subtype, which are disproportionately represented in the relapse setting. But I think it's an active drug, and I think it's one that needs to be considered for those individuals.
Another issue that came up is the question of the patient with relapsed disease, diffuse large B cell, is whether or not CD30 testing should be done and the consideration of B vedotin. Can you talk about what we know about this issue of CD30 staining and diffuse large B cell and benefits from brentuximab vedotin?
Yeah, so a subset of certainly T cell, but even B cell, large cell lymphomas can have CD30 expression. And I think it is important to test. It actually just came up last week in our heme malignancy tumor board, patient with a relapse B cell lymphoma. And one of the recommendations, it was a patient who'd had, I think, 3 prior lines of therapy. And one of the recommendations was to go back and stain for CD30. And if it's positive, to consider B vedotin. What's interesting is that in some of the studies, they're pretty small, but you can see responses in B and T cell lymphomas even when the CD30 staining is negative. And what it tells us is that the CD30 immunostain is not particularly sensitive, and you can have probably low-level CD30 expression that you won't see on a stain, but it's enough that a drug-antibody conjugate combined get into the cell and give you a therapeutic benefit. So it's an important question because it's an agent that can have utility that's often overlooked in those patients.
Any personal theories or explanation about why benefit's been seen in responses in patients who are, quote, CD30 negative?
Well, either it's working by a mechanism we don't understand, or I think it's just that the level of expression is too low. It's enough that you can get the MMAE into the cells by binding, but you're just not going to see it on an immunostain to tell you that that's truly a CD30 positive.